minimal invasive procedures. And if we dismissed babies as sentient beings, then doubly did we dismiss animals. In the 1950s, when Monty Roberts went to California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo, and wanted to study animal behavior, no such course existed. The countless books written about horses throughout history make repeated references to our dumb companions and the noble brutes. And while some writers of the Old West took an interest in mustangs, no one until fairly recently observed the herds as a biologist would in a field study. We already knew about the horse, didn't we? Barely a ripple was raised earlier this century when some 2 million wild horses on the American plains were wiped out, mostly for pet food. For most of human history, a strict hierarchy put God at the top, humankind below, with animals near the bottom. Man, says the book of Genesis, would have dominion over every creeping creature that moveth upon the earth. Most cultures gave little thought to whether the animals they were busy hunting and bossing also remembered, felt, feared, or sorrowed. Many of us no longer think that way. The rising tide of vegetarianism, especially among young people, suggests a startling new awareness of animal consciousness. In academic circles, many thinkers, among them Elizabeth Atwood Lawrence, a former veterinarian and now cultural anthropologist who has written widely on the connection between horses and humans, and Edward O. Wilson, a world-renowned ant specialist and the only two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, are among those advancing a philosophy they call biophilia. Biophilia contends that as we come to understand other organisms, how a herd of horses interacts in a pasture, the various social tasks of insects in the jungle, the mood of your dog walking ahead of you during your evening constitutional, we value them and ourselves more. The reward is in observing nature, not in controlling it. Monty Roberts, in The Man Who Listens to Horses, describes a fellow and highly successful horse trainer named Greg Ward. What should amaze trainers of the old school is how he eases young horses into work. For the first 20 days that a rider is on their backs, the horses call all the shots. If the horse wants to graze, trot, roll, the wish is granted. There's no chance for resentments or neuroses to form. A new beginning in the relationship between man and horse, Monty calls it. Generous praise, but if anyone has ushered in a new relationship, it's Monty Roberts himself, the man who heeds and understands horses like no one else before him. One of the patriarchs of thoroughbred racing in North America is Joe Taylor, 73 years old, when I talked to him early in 1997. At his tailor-made farms in Lexington, Kentucky, are stabled 550 horses. 15 years ago, he'd gone to a round pen in an open field near his farm where a man was going to demonstrate breaking a horse in a new and different way. A great many farm managers had been invited, but none came. Only Joe Taylor. I couldn't believe it, said Taylor of what he saw Monty Roberts do that day. I've been around horses all my life, but I had no concept that horses had their own language. I would love to have known about this when I was a kid. The old way, putting a horse in a corral, lassoing him, tying him to a post, and then getting on him with a pair of spurs. Unbelievable. Now we use round pens. We teach the horse that we're not going to hurt him, that were his friend. 20 years from now, Taylor predicts, everybody will be using Monty Roberts' methods. We've got to. It's the right thing. My sense is that the name Monty Roberts will have an enduring currency. He'll be remembered as the horseman who learned the language of horses, as the author of a sophisticated yet simple system of bringing the horse amiably to that first rider, and as an animal psychologist who bade us ground the schooling of the horse in the very nature of the horse. He's a wise teacher, a man of unyielding principles and uncommon courage, and one of the best friends the equine species ever had. My hope is that he's the one to lead us, for good this time, into a gentler and deeper connection with horses. Lawrence Scanlon, April, 1997. And now, the man who listens to horses.
Chapter 1. The Call of the Wild Horses. It all dates from those summers alone in the high desert, me lying on my belly and watching wild horses with my binoculars for hours at a time, straining to see in the moonlight, striving to fathom Mustang ways. I knew instinctively I'd chanced upon something important, but couldn't know that it would shape my life. In 1948, I was a boy of 13, learning the language of horses. In the wilderness of Nevada, the soil is silky and cool to the touch at dawn, and at midday will burn your skin. My summer vigils were marked off by the heat of the day and the cold of the night and a profound sense of solitude. It felt right to be there under those vast skies on that dove-gray moonscape in the company of wild and wary horses. I remember especially a dun mare with a dark stripe along her back and zebra stripes above her knees. Clearly the matriarch of the herd, she was disciplining an unruly young colt who had been roughing up foals and mares. I vividly recall how she squared up to him, her eyes on his eyes, her spine rigid, her head pointed arrow-like at the adolescent. No longer full of himself, he knew exactly what she meant. 300 yards from the herd, the outcast would know by her body position when he could return to the fold. If she faced him, he couldn't. If she showed him part of her body's long axis, he could begin to consider it. Before her act of forgiveness had to come signs of his penitence. The signals he gave back to her, the seeking of forgiveness, would later be fundamental to a technique I would develop to introduce young horses gently to saddle and rider. It was the Mustangs who taught me their silent body grammar, and the dun mare was my first teacher. I grew up in Salinas, California, where wild horses were annually put to other uses. In 1948, the wild horse race was a featured part of the Salinas Rodeo. And because I lived in a house on the rodeo grounds, or competition grounds as I called it, where my parents ran a riding school, rodeo was part of our lives. Normally, wild horses were cheap and plentiful. Doc Leach, a short, bespectacled man who was our dentist and also president of the association that governed the competition grounds, would have called the usual people and said, in effect, "Come on, folks, I need 150 Mustangs to be delivered to Salinas by July the 1st. And it would happen. But with horse meat used so extensively during the war, Mustang numbers had dwindled significantly, and by 1947, the herds in Northern California, Nevada, and Southern Oregon had diminished by as much as two-thirds, with the horses now located almost exclusively in Nevada. That year, Doc Leach's calls had fallen on deaf ears. "What Mustangs?" the Nevada ranchers had countered. "You come up here and see if you can get them yourself." The wild horse race was usually no race at all, but a kind of maniacal musical chairs played with Mustangs. But that year the Salinas Rodeo Association had to scrape together what they could find, and so it was a fairly tame wild horse race, with too few horses and too many old ones to put on the show required. The following year I saw an opportunity to provide Doc Leach with a service that would both salvage the reputation of the wild horse race and save the lives of 100 or more horses. I was only 13. He might not listen. But I was driven by both a fierce young entrepreneurial spirit and my love of the horses. In previous years, after the rodeo, the Mustangs were sent to Crow's Landing to be slaughtered for dog food. If I could somehow make them worth more than that. "What if," I proposed to Doc Leach, "I go to Nevada and get the Mustangs?" Doc Leach's eyebrows popped up above his glasses. "How are you going to do that? Walk?" No. I've made a lot of friends from trips to horse shows there. I know I can ask for help from the Campbell Ranch. Bill Dorrance, a remarkable horseman in his mid-50s who would become my mentor, had contacts at the ranch and would make the arrangements. Ralph and Vivian Carter, good horse people and friends of the family, had business to conduct near there and had agreed to help. Finally, I had a truck driver lined up.
Good for you, Doc Leach came back, a hint of mockery in his voice. I was, after all, little more than a boy.
I'd ride up to the ranges with some of the dayhands from the Campbell Ranch, and I bet I could secure 150 head.
Head of what? Chickens or horses?
He had a sophisticated sense of humor. Strong and healthy mustangs, Dr. Leach. I explained to him that my younger brother Larry and I could care for them at the competition grounds until the rodeo was held. They'll be ready on the spot, with a pair of us on hand to see they're all right. Doc Leach shifted his pipe from one corner of his mouth to the other and blinked a couple of times. That meant he was cogitating. Finally, he asked,
"What's in it for you?"
"I was thinking, sir, that after the rodeo, Larry and I could break in the Mustangs and maybe have an auction sale, so they'd be worth more than crow's bait." That was the euphemism for animals taken to Crow's Landing for slaughter. "This year," I told him, "we wouldn't have to send any animals to the abattoir. There'd definitely be more than a few that would go through the sale ridden by my brother or myself, and maybe provide someone with a useful mount, sir." He was still cogitating, so I went on. "And perhaps the Rodeo Association could show a profit at the end of the day, more than the slaughter value anyway." Doc Leach weighed the arrangement, turning it over in his mind. He was like the buyer of a used car, kicking the tires and looking for the hidden defect. When he could find none, he agreed. He offered to call up Irvin Bray and contract him to provide me with transport for the return journey. Finally, we agreed that the net proceeds of any sales were to be divided equally between the Rodeo Association and the Roberts brothers. I was on my way to Nevada to gather 150 head of Mustangs. It would prove to be the most important opportunity of my life, to study horses in their natural groups in the wild. For the next 3 years, I would be crossing the Sierra Nevada to the high desert beyond, to live alongside wild herds for several weeks at a time. From that experience, I would begin to learn a language, a silent language which I have subsequently termed Equus. With that as a springboard, I would assemble a framework of ideas and principles that would guide my life's work with horses. I would have none of this were it not for my time as a teenager, spent in the company of Mustangs. In June 1948, Ralph and Vivian Carter and I put our horses and our equipment in the van and headed off. The Carters were an odd couple. Older than Ralph by 15 years, short, stocky, and strong, Vivian had been an exceptional rider as a teenager and very successful in the show ring, but in her late 20s a horse bucked her into the trunk of a tree. She would still ride well, but walk with a decided limp for the rest of her life. Nevertheless, the smile on her face was constant and spoke of her inner beauty. She was far and away a better horse person than Ralph was, and I learned to listen more to her than to him. Ralph had the appearance of an all-American Scandinavian cross. Blonde hair and eyebrows, blue eyes, tall and handsome, broad at the shoulders, narrow at the hips. The van carrying us weaved back and forth around the foothills before climbing the Sierra Nevada, following roads cut by our forefathers into the stern, harsh landscape 400 miles north and west of Salinas. North beyond Battle Mountain lay the high desert and the Campbell Ranch, and the vast, empty tract of federal land owned by the Bureau of Land Management. What I noticed first as the door of the truck swung open was the air. How thin it was. Climbing down from the cab, I knew already that this landscape would be like nothing I'd ever encountered. The horizons, the sky, stretched endlessly. I had the sense of being on a different planet. The lunar landscape was covered in sage and rough grasses and cut by deep barrancas, ravines, overgrown with stunted trees. Somewhere in this vast natural wilderness were wild horses. Indian dayhands at the Campbell Ranch were detailed to help us.
I was half expecting them to recommend the same trick my Cherokee ancestors had apparently used. Before driving the Mustangs toward the trap, push them in the opposite direction for a day or so. The horse's tendency is to press back against the control inflicted on them. The dayhands, though, had another plan. Some 50 miles from the homestead, they had built a corral about a quarter of a mile long. They had searched for a heavily traveled canyon and set the corral at the bottom end. From the air, it bore the shape of a keyhole, with two sides angled into a narrow gap and a circular area beyond. The posts and fencing were camouflaged with sage and brushwood. It was a 2-day ride to reach this makeshift structure, and when we got there, the dayhands walked us around and explained how the Mustang should be driven into the wedge at the bottom and funneled through the narrowest part into the circular area, where they would slow up and be forced to turn. Riders, meanwhile, would come down the wings and close the gate across the narrowest part of the keyhole. Familiar with this canyon, the horses wouldn't have seen a vehicle, a building, or even a fence post to scare them off. But where were the horses? They weren't to be seen by any casual scanning of the earth's surface, a large part of which seemed to lie spread in front of us, a fissured plateau baking in the sun. The Indians pointed here and there. The whereabouts of the wild horse herds couldn't be guessed accurately, and the ranch hands were happy to allow the Carters and me to head off and start bringing them back ourselves. They had work to do, but they'd help us complete the job. For this undertaking, I had 2 saddle horses and 2 pack horses. The latter were piled high with blankets and utensils. Brownie was my number 1 saddle horse, but in addition I had Sergeant and Burgundy as well as a 2nd pack horse, Oriole. The going was stony and rough. The barrancas in particular made for precarious riding, so I'd be leading Brownie on foot much of the time. He was precious to me, and I wanted to save him from too much wear and tear if I could. I was anticipating the adventure of a lifetime, and Brownie caught my excitement and shared it, or perhaps it came from deep inside him. When he took his first steps into this cracked and thirsty land, this son of a Mustang was heading home. Brownie was always a steady and well-mannered horse, but the conviction with which he carried me into his home territory hinted that he knew something I did not. Ralph Vivian and I broke camp at dawn and hurried to stamp out the remains of the fire and bury it, kicking at the loose earth, enjoying the burst of activity if only to warm ourselves in the chill air. We wore yesterday's clothes, and as we mounted our horses and started to peel the oranges that my mother insisted I eat every day, the sun rose like a golden disk, watery at first, but then burning with increasing strength as the morning wore on. Things began to go wrong, or so I thought, as soon as we saw the first herd of 50 or so wild horses. Brownie caught their scent as we traversed a barranca. Large stones littered its slopes where stunted trees struggled to suck enough water and take advantage of the shelter. Though it was dangerous, you could ride the bottoms of these canyons, along natural paths formed by the scouring action of flash floods. As we descended, Brownie's heels dragged behind him when he tried to load more weight onto his hocks to take the strain. At one point he stopped dead, concentrating on something I couldn't see or hear. I knew from his lack of agitation and the fact that he was keen to move on in the same direction as his ears were pointing, that he had scented this herd of his brothers and sisters, the Mustangs of northern Nevada. But when we caught up with them, and they were already moving away, fully aware of our presence, Ralph and I had different ideas on how to proceed. The Carters, not unreasonably, wanted to press on and simply drive the horses back toward the ranch. Because we had to cover 50 or 60 miles of ground on the return journey, we'd have to go relatively fast to stick to our schedule. I, on the other hand, wanted to stop and simply observe the horses. There was something compelling about seeing them as a family, the alpha male or breeding stallion circling and lifting his tail, stepping out with a high, proud action and acknowledging our presence. It made me want to melt into the background and see what could be seen, without subjecting them to our interference. It was almost as if I wanted to be a horse myself, so thoroughly had I taken their side. These horses weren't only Brownie's brothers and sisters, they were mine too. I wanted to understand them.
and I was more than ever certain that I knew less than I thought I did. This unspoken conflict of interest between the Carters and me generated an unspoken compromise. They hurried me along, and I slowed them down. We none of us got what we wanted. As we pressed the Mustangs ahead of us, we saw the signals that would be obvious to anyone with experience of horses. A pair of forward ears shows interest in something anterior or in front. Forward ears with head high denotes interest in something in front but far off. Forward ears with the head held low indicates interest in something up close near the ground. The Mustangs we pursued held their heads in normal position, but with a split ear, one forward and one back, signifying interest in something in front, but also concern for anything to the rear. Us. The ears were like beacons that told us the directions of their focus. If their ears were hanging relaxed, and the horses stood with one hind leg bent and resting, we could assume we were unobserved. At that moment, the signal said, these horses had no concern for their safety. If a horse pins his ears back on his neck, he's angry. We watched one Mustang, ears pinned, maneuvering to position his rear legs and take action against another animal. He was angry, aggressive, and dangerous. Once or twice we saw the stallion pin his ears back and stick his nose straight out as far as he could reach. He had his head lowered to just below wither height, so that from the shoulder forward the neck and head looked like an arrow. His eyes were steely, and he was moving forward in a stalking mode. He must have possessed very active testicles, for this stance is exclusive to the full-grown adult male. Only as the male reaches potential for supremacy within the family group are you likely to see this particular display. As Ralph and Vivian and I circled this first group, turning them this way and that to point them back toward the trap set for them, I learned that a horse's field of vision is nearly 360 degrees, with only a slim cut of land right behind him, which he cannot see, and an even slimmer cut directly in front. Watching the stallion badger the mares in his defensive role, we could confirm that when he switched his tail, other than when clearing insects off his body, he was not content. This we knew already. A trainer who puts too much pressure on a horse with spurs or whip will create what is called a switch-tail horse, and in Western competition, significant points are lost if a horse switches his tail while performing. Perhaps the most important piece of knowledge that my first foray into the high desert of Nevada indelibly engraved on my mind was this tenet. There are two types of animal, the fight animal and the flight animal. It bears repeating that the horse is a flight animal. If I knew it before, I understand it now in a more profound way. It sounds obvious, but it's critical to remember that given the slightest excuse, a horse will say, I don't want to be near you. I feel there is danger if I stay. The flight animal wants only to reproduce and survive. Fear is the tool that allows him to survive. This has to be respected in any dealings with a horse, or he'll be misunderstood. Humankind, however, is a fight animal. Our preoccupation is with the chase and having dominion over other creatures in order to eat them or use them for our own ends. The horse, then, sits at the far end of the flight animal spectrum, while humankind, the supreme fight animal, is his clear opposite. In order to gain a horse's trust and willing cooperation, both parties must meet in the middle. However, it's totally the responsibility of the human to achieve this. The only way is to earn the trust of the horse and never abuse his status as a flight animal. If I learned anything on that first trip, it was that I needed a much longer time if I was to get what I was looking for, a true understanding of how horses behave in the wild. My frustration was that it couldn't happen under these conditions. When we got back to the trap in the Barranca, we merely jammed a bunch of horses into the circular pen, brought up the hired transport, and carted them off. We didn't select suitable animals, grade them by age or sex. Along with the more suitable younger adolescent colts came older animals and even lactating mares, meaning that somewhere behind was a foal facing certain death. In short, we were distressingly insensitive. At least I knew what I wanted to do next time.
With our convoy of trucks hauling 150 Mustangs, all of them banging and kicking in the trailers, we arrived back at the competition grounds in Salinas. When we dropped down the trailer ramps, the horses scooted into their new home, a huge stock corral near the track. The horses were seeing for the first time barns and other buildings, and the arena where they would be racing in just a month's time before thousands of people. The Mustangs snorted and blew and ran round the perimeter of the corral, astonished at their new circumstances. I rushed into the house, proud to tell my parents what we had done. "And," I said, "I'm going to take more time next year, and then I can see what those horses are all about. They're barely going to know I'm there." My mother was receptive and listened intently. "What do you think you'll find out?" "I don't know, but something. The way they communicate as a family. That's what I hope." My father was not pleased at all. "About all you'll find out is it's cold at night and hot in the day. You'll find out those Mustangs don't want to have much to do with you or your fancy notions." Horses understood one thing only, my father barked, and that was fear. If you didn't hurt them first, they'd hurt you. As for the 150 Mustangs, we, that is to say, humankind, were going to hurt them quite badly in the wild horse race. But it wasn't until later that I realized how responsible I was for that. For all my entrepreneurial spirit, I was, in the end, a child, with much to learn. Some 20,000 spectators came to watch this popular part of the rodeo each of the 4 days. Larry and I were in among a crush of people pressed against the fence. Waiting on the track were a number of teams of 3 men each, all of them dressed in full cowboy regalia. They were as likely to get hurt as the horses were, and you could tell they were nervous by the way they fidgeted. The teams milled about some distance apart from one another, waiting to have their wild horse delivered to them, each team with a western saddle parked ready on the ground nearby. Riders would come onto the track on their saddle horses, each one literally dragging a wild Mustang on the end of a 15-foot lead rope connected to the horn of his saddle. At the sight of this, the crowd started to holler and cheer and stamp their feet. Behind the Mustangs and pushing them forward were more riders. Wild with terror, the Mustangs were bucking and running, diving and pulling on the ends of their ropes. I imagine the Roman circus generated something like the same hysteria. Convinced they were coming to a savage end, the horses raged as they were dragged in. The crowd was whooping. The riders then handed the lead rope of each Mustang to the first member of each team, called the anchor, the biggest and heaviest of the 3 men. The anchors dug in their heels and set about trying to keep these 900-pound wild animals as much as possible in one place. The second man is called the mugger, and his is probably the most dangerous job. The mugger travels down the lead rope, hand over hand, turning this way and that to follow the line as the Mustang fights and plunges like the wild animal he is. As fast as he can, the mugger has to grasp the horse around his neck, try to put him into a headlock, and pinch his top lips. The idea is to hold him still long enough for another man to put a saddle on him. My heart was in my mouth as the battle began. Some of the men were thrown off the ropes before they reached the horses. Others had better luck and were already hanging in there, wrestling with these animals like they were in a barroom brawl. The third member of the teams, the rider, began to dart in, carrying a saddle on his arm, trying to throw it on and cinch it down. Imagine the noise and the confusion. My nerves were screwed to the highest pitch just watching. Several men limped off, too injured to continue, while others ran forward to take their places. One man was dragged out unconscious from under the feet of a horse and carried off. By now, some riders had managed to tighten the cinch and were jumping up and aiming to stay on long enough to be handed the lead rope, which is their only method of guidance. It was a scene of utter chaos, with horses bolting in all directions, some with riders on board, some without. Riders who had managed to get mounted were attempting to race each other once around a half-mile track and were using whatever methods of hazing they could. They were shouting and spurring their horses and pulling at the rope to try to turn them the right way. I lived the excitement as would any 13-year-old raised in the culture of rodeo, but at the same time I recoiled against the mad cruelty. There were some crashing falls,
and I felt the impact of each and every one of them as though it was happening to me. One horse, I learned later, had broken his jaw. An excited voice exclaimed behind me each time there was a horse writhing on the ground. "Crow's bait! Crow's bait!" By the time some riders were up in the saddle and racing around the track, the roar of the crowd doubled in volume and the horses were running for their lives, their heads held low and ears pinned back to their necks. They raced once around the half-mile track, and the winner threw one hand in the air and continued sailing around until his horse had slowed enough for him to leap down and take his applause. He would stand to face the audience, his expression one of utmost excitement and triumph. The wild horse race causes several deaths among horses every year in Salinas, and it's the same at 40 or so other rodeos around the country. I believe it should be abolished. The task now was to make the Mustangs worth more alive than dead. Larry and I had just 60 days, August and September, to break as many of them as possible. A schooled Mustang might fetch a buyer at the October auction. An unbroken one was destined for Crow's Landing. Their lives, and our hopes for a profitable arrangement with Doc Leach, were in our own hands. Owing to injuries and deaths in the race, only 130 of the Mustangs were left to us. We turned them out in the corrals, where they were no doubt glad to relax after the trauma. Their rest would be brief. My brother and I agreed that I would take roughly two-thirds of them to his third. My first concern, though, was to hide my new ways of thinking from my father, who broke horses the traditional violent way. Happily, a pair of barns ran down either side of the pen where I'd school the Mustangs, so I was sequestered from his view. Despite the impending deadline, I wanted to continue experimenting with the communication skills that so intrigued me. My aim was to refine a technique that used the horse's respect and cooperation, not the one that forced its servitude. I believed it was important to concentrate on this, in part because of the deadline. I was sure my way would be quicker. But I also felt in my bones that I had chanced upon something new that would change the way human beings relate to horses. Although my technique would improve dramatically after the following year's expedition to Nevada, even at this stage I had come to think of my process as entirely different from that of breaking horses. That word has connotations of violence and domination. I changed the nomenclature. From that day on, I called my method starting horses. If traditional breaking was designed to generate fear in the horse, I wanted to create trust. If the old way involved ropes and tying horses' heads and legs, I wanted no part of that either. A significant moment came when I realized I could cause trust in a horse without pain or restraint. In short, instead of telling young horses, "You must," I wanted to ask them, "Will you?" I knew from the very beginning that engaging the horse's trust would work. My technique was still haphazard and unrefined, but I got there. After the starting process, I recruited from our riding school four or five of my top students and so brought on to a good standard about 80 of my 100 Mustangs. The students were willing volunteers, and together we learned a great deal from every horse. On the day of the sale, my 80 horses were ridden through the ring and my brothers were ridden as well. Altogether, the sale took in just under $6,000. Doc Leach was happy with the results. He got back his $5,000 investment in the herd and made a small profit. This was unprecedented. Acquiring Mustangs for the wild horse race traditionally meant a substantial loss. My brother and I were less happy, at least financially speaking. For 2 months' work, our share of the profit amounted to $250 each. Even in those days, this was not a wage to brag about. It was more like a nod and a thank you. But given what I had started to learn about wild horses in those first few months, I had an even better feeling of time well spent. This was just the beginning. The following summer was perhaps the finest of my life. I would spend much of it alone in the high desert, in what I came to see as an outdoor university. I was a freshman at Mustang U. But first I had to make some new arrangements with Doc Leach,
What can I do for you, son?
I have an idea how to improve the wild horse race this year.
You didn't do so badly for us last time.
How about we reduce the number of Mustangs we haul back here?
And that's to improve the race, is it?
Well, I explained, I noticed that you didn't use all 150 head. You picked out the best two-thirds of them.
That's right, we did.
What if we choose the best two-thirds of them up there in Nevada instead of down here in Salinas? Then we'd only be transporting 100 head instead of 150, and we could lower the overhead.
Even at 14, I had a pretty firm grasp of cost. Doc Leach looked down at me. Who's going to judge the best 100 head? You?
That's right, sir. Then we can avoid bringing the lactating mares and the older animals in the first place.
Doc Leach smiled. You've got a point, I have to admit.
I recommended that we gather 500 head and select the best 100 adolescent colts and fillies. Adolescent, in Mustang terms, means an animal 3 to 5 years old, since the limited nutrition and harsh desert environment delay their maturity. Mustangs cover vast territories to feed, and the saying is that they can graze at 20 miles an hour. I paid a trucker to transport myself, Brownie, Sergeant, and Oriole up to the Campbell Ranch. Ralph and Vivian Carter agreed to join me later on this adventure. The helpers and truck convoy would come up with them. But for 3 weeks I would be alone in the Nevada desert with the Mustangs. I would have the time to move slowly and observe them without interfering in any way. The Campbell Ranch had prior information on the location of family groups, which were sometimes 10 miles apart. I intended to bring each family group toward the trap in the Barranca one by one, very slowly, observing them as I went. Once again, I was glad to have Brownie as one of my saddle horses for this all-important experience. I patted his neck as we rode out over the high desert ground. Oriole and Sergeant walked along behind, and in addition I had our black-and-white stock dog called Bobby, 3 pairs of binoculars, 2 spares, for I'd have been lost without them, a handgun and a rifle. When we reached the first horizon, I twisted around in my saddle and watched the outbuildings of the Campbell Ranch disappear from sight as we moved down the opposite side of the slope. We were on our own. It felt good to be riding across this open ground again, with its rocky barrancas where the cottonwood and aspen trees grew. I'd have to be extra vigilant for rattlesnakes. Worse were the invisible crevices. You might be galloping across what looked like a flat, unbroken expanse of desert in pursuit of a herd when, suddenly, a 6-foot crevice yawned at your horse's feet. The Mustangs, who usually spotted you before you spotted them, used these depressions cleverly. They would travel in them at the slightest suspicion of danger, and from my vantage point a mile away it seemed that the horses in my sights had suddenly vanished. My father was right, at least about the weather. The days were hot, the nights cold. Occasionally rainstorms would lash me and the horses for an hour. Big, billowy, high desert clouds would give rise to electrical storms. I was living on a diet mostly of jerky, a cured meat, plus pancake mix and salami, as well as oranges. To find the first family group of horses, I had to consider their food source. The Mustangs would eat the sage and the chamise if they were desperate, but they preferred the grama, brome, and rye grasses. When I caught up with my first group, my aim was to integrate with the herd as closely as I could. Either they would accept me as no threat, which meant staying more than a mile distant, or I could try to get closer without their knowing I was there. The latter option quickly evaporated. The horses caught my scent from a mile away and began to move off. They were little more than dots on the plateau, and already they were going away. I left Oriole, my bay pack horse, behind because he was proving rather clumsy and often stumbled over stones, the noise of which carried over vast distances. Not that he cared. I was beginning to wonder about this Oriole character. His ears were always at half-mast, neither forward nor backward. He was either a deep thinker or a little dumb, maybe both. After lightly hobbling him and leaving Sergeant to keep him company, I continued on foot, leading Brownie. We used the barrancas as cover and stayed downwind, moving quietly. Given the time to move slowly and think about what was happening, I was surprised by how hypersensitive the herd was to our presence. If Brownie just scuffed a rock, I could see their ears flick in our direction. I could get within a quarter mile of the herd, but no closer. I was running out of cover, and even though I was downwind of them, they would see this no more ground. Brownie and I settled down by a cottonwood tree, and I counted the horses, trying to log their markings so I could distinguish one from another. My binoculars were key. When I see young people today strapping on virtual reality helmets, entranced by the world they enter, I'm reminded of how I felt when I looked through binoculars at that herd of wild horses. They seemed close enough to touch. I could see subtle shifts of the eyes, ears, tongue. These were pure movements, untainted by human intervention. That day I would watch for 8 continuous hours. I noticed in particular the dun mare. Older than most of the others, with a heavier belly that hinted at many pregnancies, she seemed to issue a lot of commands. She ordered her group to move off. She started, the others followed. She stopped, they did likewise. It seemed she was the wisest, and they knew it. What I was observing, in fact, was the dominant mare. Many people likely still think that the stallion runs the show. The breeding or dominant stallion, sometimes called the alpha male or lead male, will skirt the herd and defend it from marauders. His motivation is to prevent anyone or anything from stealing his harem. But it was the dun mare who was in charge of the day-to-day running of this group. There was no mistaking it. And then I saw an extraordinary sequence of events. A light bay colt was behaving badly. He was about 20 months old, I guessed, with a vast amount of feathering around his fetlocks and down the backs of his legs, and a mane running down well below his neckline. He took a run at a filly and gave her a kick. The filly cowered and hobbled off, and the colt looked pleased with himself. He was only about 550 pounds in weight, but very aware of the fact that he owned a pair of testicles. Then he committed another crime. A little foal approached him, moving his mouth in a suckling action to indicate he was no threat but subservient. Just a foal. That cut no ice with this colt. He launched himself at his younger cousin and took a bite out of the foal's backside. The bay colt was a terrorist. Immediately after the attack, he pretended nothing had happened. He went neutral, as though trying to avoid blame. Each time he behaved badly, the dun mare, the matriarch, weaved a little closer to him. I became certain that she was watching for any more of this behavior. She showed no apparent sign of interest, but she had left her station and was edging closer to him all the time. The mare witnessed about 4 such episodes before she finally made her move. Now she stood within 20 yards. Still, the cream-colored colt couldn't help himself. He launched at a grown mare, grabbed the nape of her neck, and bit down hard. The dun mare did not hesitate. In an instant, she went from neutral to full-blown anger. She pinned her ears back and ran at him, knocking him down. As he struggled to his feet, she whirled and knocked him down again. While this chastisement unfolded, the other members apparently took no notice. The dun mare ended by driving the colt 300 yards from the herd and left him there, alone. Amazed, I tried to fathom what I was seeing. The mare took up a position on the edge of the herd to keep him in exile. She kept her eyes on his and faced up to him. She was freezing him out. It terrified the colt to be left alone. For a flight animal, this was tantamount to a death sentence. The predators will get any horse long separated from the group. He walked back and forth, his head close to the ground, several times executing this strange, uncomfortable gait. It looked like a sign of obedience, similar to a human's bow. Then the colt made his way to the other side of the herd and attempted to sneak back in that way, but the dun mare had followed his circle. Again she drove him out, running at him until he had fled another 300 yards. Returning to her post on the edge of the herd, she kept her body square on his and never once took her eye off him. He stood there, and I noticed a lot of licking and chewing going on, although with all this drama he had eaten nothing. I remembered the foal and how he had snapped his mouth in an obvious signal of humility, as though he were saying, "I'm not a threat to you." Was this colt now saying the same thing to his matriarch? By this time it was getting dark, and I'd have to get back to the other horses. I wanted the moon bright that night. I wanted desperately to see how the tale would end. I scooped up Brownie's reins and rode back to where Sergeant and Oriole were waiting. My intention was to camp there and continue observing the dialogue between mare and colt. When I got back, Oriole was standing with his nose in a bush. Then he lifted his head sharply, his whole body tense with surprise. A cloud of bees surrounded his head. This was an emergency, for the horse was clearly being stung. Oriole took a few paces backward and then tried a couple more sideways. He tried it with his head held low and then jerked it up again. No luck. Then he shook himself like a dog emerging from water. The bees still hovered, a cloud hooked on a mountaintop. This was a puzzle, and Oriole had nearly run out of tricks. There was only one left. He tossed his head up and down, evidently figuring that if he did this long enough, the bees would get bored and leave, which is what they did. Oriole didn't seem unduly perturbed by the experience. It was one of life's many mysteries, the one and only time I ever saw a bee swarm take a shine to a horse's head. Oriole was an accident-prone, affable character who always got into trouble, but somehow made it seem funny. Once he spiked himself by walking into a shard of wood. I am unsure how he did it, and only he could have done it. But a 2-foot-long splinter was driven through his nose and the roof of his mouth. It was a painful sight, not at all amusing. But this was Oriole we were dealing with. He was most apologetic and sorry for himself, and allowed me to perform the grisly task of pulling out the splinter. He was then left with a hole in his nose the size of my thumb, blood pouring from the wound. I took off the bright red bandana I customarily wore and used it to plug the hole and stem the bleeding. There stood Oriole with a red flag flying in the middle of his face, and every time he took a drink, the cloth would soak up the water. Then it would drip like tears. It was a sorry sight, but I had a laugh. The sun now sank surprisingly fast down the western slope of the sky, as though itself desiring rest from a hard day's work. I made camp and hurried to settle Brownie, Sergeant, and Oriole with their feed. From its place in that vast sky, the moon cast the landscape in a new and surprisingly generous light. I picked up my binoculars and found I could see clearly for quite a distance. I didn't realize it then, but my night vision was likely helped by the fact that I'm totally colorblind. I know that the color of the high desert is dove gray only because others have told me. Mine is a rare condition, quite separate from the more common one in which an individual cannot properly distinguish colors. When I was young, no one believed that I could see only in black and white, but I've subsequently learned that I see in a very different way from normally sighted people. Oliver Sacks, in his study of The Case of the Colorblind Painter, describes how his subject had a car accident that caused him to lose all perception of color. But along with that terrible loss came an unexpected gift. People's figures might be visible and recognizable half a mile off. His vision had become much sharper, that of an eagle. Distressed by his condition, the artist became nocturnal, and at night his extraordinary vision allowed him to identify a license plate 4 blocks away. Using the binoculars, I caught sight of my herd. To my astonishment, the dun mare was now grooming the troublesome colt. She was giving him little scrapes on his neck and hindquarters with her teeth, and generally fussing over him. She had let him back in. Now she was keeping him close by and giving him a lot of attention. She worked away at the root of his tail, hips, and withers. Purgatory was behind him. This was heaven. As it turned out, night was a better time to watch the wild herds. Mustangs fear attacks from predators mostly at dawn and dusk. At night they relax and their social interaction is more marked. It became a habit to watch them by the light of the moon, and I would usually sleep from about 1:30 a.m. until 5:30 a.m. For the next 2 summers, I'd round up mustangs for the Salinas Rodeo.
and nothing I saw ever matched the exchange between the dun mare and that light bay colt. It was educational to watch the matriarch disciplining young adolescent horses because so much happened. The youthful energy and inexperience of the gang of adolescents drove them to make mistakes, much like the young of any species. Often like a child, the colt would reoffend immediately after being let back in, to test the disciplinary system and to gain back lost ground. He might fight another colt or bother the fillies. The dun mare came right back and disciplined him again. Each time he sinned, she drove him out and kept him out before letting him back in and welcoming him into the group with extensive grooming. The third time he sinned, he practically owned up and exited by himself, grumbling about it but accepting his fate. Then finally, his teenage rebellion ceased. Now cloyingly sweet, he had become a positive nuisance, wandering about and asking every horse, "Do you need any grooming?" when all they wanted was to be left alone to eat. For 4 days, the dun mare had made the education of this awful brat her number one priority, and it had paid off. As I watched the mare's training procedures with this adolescent and others, I began to understand the language she used, and it was exciting to recognize the exact sequence of signals that would pass between her and the younger horses. It really was a language, predictable, discernible, and effective. The silent aspect of her commands is worth dwelling on because we often underrate a language that uses a different medium from our own. As I was to learn much later, the most common form of communication on this planet takes place silently, in the dark of the deep sea, where animals use intricate lighting systems called bioluminescence to attract mates, ward off predators, attract prey, and otherwise convey all the signals necessary for their existence. Body language is not confined to humans or horses. It constitutes the most common form of communication between all animate objects. In the desert, the dun mare constantly schooled the foals and yearlings, and they responded to her without a sound. The stallion security system required near absolute silence, and his investigations of mating potential were also conducted soundlessly. The Mustangs were happy with one another, upset with one another, guided and advised by one another, all in silence. I learned that in the equine universe, every degree of a horse's movement has a reason. Nothing is trivial. Nothing is to be dismissed. A horse raised alone, I now know, will still speak equus. Genetics imparts much of the language. But the lone horse's communication is dull, less defined. A Mustang raised in the wild in a herd, on the other hand, displays as pure a form of the equine tongue as I could have hoped to find anywhere. I'd learned much later, while starting horses in a round pen, a rich code of signs and subsigns. Keeping my mouth closed invited the horse's discomfort. Opening it slightly was fine. Opening a fist on the side of my body away from the horse drew him in, while opening a fist close to him sent him away. Fingers open stirred one response, fingers closed another. Hands above my head with fingers splayed provoked true panic. Perhaps it triggers primordial memories of cat claws. Whether I'm moving, standing still, facing the horse or away, all this matters as the horse reads my body language and I read his. I can now enumerate about 100 or more signs the horse will respond to, and the vocabulary is still growing. The key ingredient in the equine language is the positioning of the body and its direction of travel. The attitude of the body relative to the long axis of the spine and the short axis, this is critical to their vocabulary. It is their vocabulary. When the dun mare squared up and faced the colt, she was holding up a keep-out sign. If she showed him part of her long axis, he could begin to consider returning to the herd. But before she would say, "I forgive you," he had to say, "I'm sorry." If the colt paced with his nose close to the ground, then he was asking for a chance to end his isolation and to renegotiate his position with her. He was saying, "I'm obedient. I'm willing to listen." If he showed her the long axis of his body, then he was offering vulnerable areas to her,
and asking to be forgiven. Their eye contact also spoke volumes. When she was holding him out there, she always kept one eye directly on his, sometimes for uncomfortably long periods of time. When her eye slid a short distance off his, he knew he might be allowed back in. I came to realize how subtle was this reading of eye contact. Even when I was unfamiliar to this herd, I could cause a horse to alter his direction and pace of movement by changing which part of his body I looked at, even from a distance. When the colt trotted out to suffer his exile, he would throw his nose out in a circular motion. Translation, I didn't intend to do that. I'm sorry. It wasn't my idea. It just happened. It was the other guy's fault. The Dunmare had to judge whether or not to believe him. I could see her thinking about it. Sometimes she bought it, sometimes not. The licking and chewing action of the colt's mouth was a signal of penitence. He was saying to her, "Look, I'm a herbivore. I'm no threat to you. I'm eating over here." Observing all this, I could make sense of the yo-yo effect once described by my Uncle Ray. Cherokee hunters had for centuries exploited the tendency of prey animals, once chased, to circle back and hunt the hunter. Press the young horse away, and his instinct is to return. The dun mare advanced on him, then retreated. When I made this connection between the mare's discipline and Uncle Ray's story, it was as if synapses in my brain all fired simultaneously. A term sprang to my mind, advance and retreat. In time I would grasp just how exact a language it was. There were precise messages, whole phrases and sentences that always meant the same thing, always had the same effect. Perhaps, it occurred to me, I could use the same silent system of communication myself. If I understood how to do it, I could effectively cross over the boundary between human, the ultimate fight animal, and horse, the flight animal. Using their language, their system of communication, I could create a strong bond of trust. I would achieve cross-species communication. Advance and retreat also offered a psychological explanation for why horses are into-pressure animals. In my 20s, during a short career riding bucking horses, I once waited in the chute on a horse who was leaning hard on one side, pinching my leg against the boards. Six cowboys were pushing against the horse's body, trying to move him over, but the harder they pushed, the more the horse leaned. Finally, one wise old horseman chanced by and put one finger against the horse's other side, as if pushing against it. Instantly, the horse moved into that little bit of pressure, and my pinched leg was just as instantly grateful. Horses, as a natural response, do not move away from pressure. They move into it, particularly if the pressure is applied to their flanks. The wild dogs that prey on horses on every continent attack the horse's belly, aiming to tear a hole in the stomach wall so the intestines will drop out. The dogs can then fall back and track the horse, confident that a meal is imminent. Once flight is no longer a clear option, the horse's best defense is not to run but to turn into the onslaught and kick. If they run from a bite, their skin will more likely tear. I'm convinced that this explains a phenomenon recognized by all good trainers. Poke a forefinger into a horse's side and he will move against the pressure rather than away from it. It's perhaps the single most important thing to remember in training horses. Horses are into-pressure animals. Go into pain, nature told the horse, and the horse heeded the message. Over the years, I'd expand my equus vocabulary, but even the more refined signs would exist within this all-important umbrella concept of advance and retreat that I learned at the age of 13. Later that same summer, I witnessed a fight between two stallions. Water was in short supply that year, and I watched, fascinated, as the matriarchs made frantic efforts to get their families watered and fed. The different family groups were lining up at a waterhole like airliners in a holding pattern. The groups had to keep their distance because the stallions wouldn't tolerate it otherwise. Their territorial instincts were in conflict with those of the matriarchs,
and this made all the horses edgy. Among them was a bachelor group, young males who had left their family groups and were now scrimmaging among themselves, honing their fighting skills for the day when they would make a challenge for a herd of their own. Then the inevitable happened. A bachelor clashed with the alpha male of a family group waiting in line for water. A stallion fight is one of the few times you'll hear sounds from a Mustang. I found the noise of battle chilling, but the mares took no notice of the terrible squealing and screaming at the perimeter of their group. This was a contest that one horse would win. A draw wasn't in the cards. The two males reared and pawed each other with their hooves, plunged and kicked and bit. It continued for 5 or 6 hours, well into the night, and though my eyelids were drooping, I had to watch. Just when it seemed the stallion had won and the bachelor was about to hobble off, the latter redoubled his attack, though his leg was torn and bleeding from the teeth raking his hide. Limping toward the stallion, practically carrying his hind leg, the bachelor waded in again. When the younger stallion finally left, he didn't return. Before long, the predators would gather around him, and he would be their meal for the next day or two. The bachelor knew it, too. A vanquished male will often commit a kind of suicide, deliberately seeking the areas where the cats are, almost offering himself.